Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science, whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere. We'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Today, we are going to talk about food, specifically deer food, what deer eat, why they eat it, and ultimately, we're going to talk about how to manage for it. But before we talk about deer food, Steve, let's talk about your lunch, your food. What'd you have for lunch today?
Oh, man. I love lunch. You know, I try to eat it every day.
Most people do.
Whether I need it or not, I enjoy it. I went for, well, generally I try to eat kind of healthy. So I went to just next door, basically here on campus. We have this new cafeteria called the Fresh Food Cafeteria, and they have really good salads and light sandwiches and stuff, along with pizza and all the other kind of stuff, fried chicken. But I go over there and I got kind of a salad with some meat on it.
So this could have a little bearing to what we're going to talk about later. So why did the foods you select, why did you select them?
The specific foods, well, I'm at my age, fairly young, but getting older every day.
Come on.
I'm trying to eat healthy to maintain my life, keep me active as long as I can. And I've got a little bit of a, you know, developing a little mid-range bonus storage that I'd rather not have. So just trying to eat the kind of food that is hopefully going to keep me healthy that I also like.
So you're trying to go from a mature buck, what he looks like in the pre-rut, to what he looks like in the post-rut.
Yeah, only I don't want to have any holes in me and scrape. Yeah, I'm not a fighter.
Yeah. Okay, so the bottom line is you selected foods because they tasted good to you. Now, you thought about it. You consciously thought about it. A deer's not going to think about it. But you consciously thought about the choices you made, and those foods tasted good to you, and they provided nutrients that your body wanted or needed.
Yeah, and this is not the first time I've gone to that cafeteria. And in the past, I've evaluated different other offerings on the salad bar, so I've kind of refined. Sometimes I'd have a salad with certain, you know, components to it, and I'd come back after and try to sit in the office and work, and I'd just be a little uncomfortable. So I've refined what I choose based on previous experiences.
That's you're tapping into a lot of theories there as well. So that's that post-ingestive feedback system as well that animals can use.
Absolutely.
They remember, they get a negative feedback or a positive feedback, then they go back to that same place again.
Yeah.
But another theory, Steve, whether you know it or not, you're working with, you did something close by.
Yes.
You did something where you could acquire calories very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You did it in more or less a safe manner. You had to cross a road, but it was pretty much a safe. That's optimal foraging theory.
Yes, it is. Certainly was. And, you know, I wasn't expecting to be attacked while I was there, but, you know, it is a student cafeteria and some, you know, I'm pretty hard on my exams. So, you know, if there were some mad students, I'd want to get what I need to eat and then get back to my office and not be out there eating and, you know, being available for attack by some angry student.
That sounds like the ruminant strategy. Eat quick and hide.
Yes.
Just so happens we're talking about deer. So enough about you, Steve. Let's talk about today about deer and deer foods and why it matters.
But what about discussing what kind of wine I'm going to drink tonight?
We're talking about food. Yeah, right, we're not going to get into the fermented beverage stuff, but at least not in this podcast. So let's talk about why it matters. Let's first, how about from a hunter's view? Why should a hunter even care about what foods deer select?
Well, back to your comment a minute ago, deer do two things. They hide and they eat. And hunters want to know what deer will eat so that they can then identify where those plants are on the property and set up near them or along the way to them to harvest a deer. Or if they're not currently on the property, perhaps they need to plant them or do some habitat management to get those kind of foods productive on the property so that when the deer's not hiding, it's eating, and hopefully it's eating where the hunter is.
Yeah. So if you want to capitalize on a hunting opportunity, you always position yourself between cover and food. And if you know what the foods are, that creates more efficient hunting for the hunter.
Yeah.
Okay. How about from a management perspective, a manager's view? Why is this information important?
Well, the manager that is planting food plots, you know, he or she wants to plant a food plot that is going to be attractive to the deer. Just because you can grow something green doesn't mean that it's going to be attractive to deer. So the manager wants to, if the manager is also the hunter, the manager wants to produce forages that are going to be attractive to deer, bring deer to the food plot, and make the hunters happy.
Okay, how about more of a holistic or a long-term view?
Good point. You know, really, a manager should be looking at a large scale area. Perhaps it's their property, and that property should have all the basic needs of an animal's daily life and hopefully annual life present on it for it to be successful. And so what you need to think about is within the area of your, that you can impact, is there hiding cover? Is there travel cover? Is there food? And what percentages of the habitat is made up by food and cover? And really, you know, we'll talk later about the specific kinds of food that deer eat, but one of the great things about deer and the habitats that they live in and the foods that they eat, if you have good cover 6 feet and below that the deer feel safe in, and you can make that cover also be the foods that they eat, then you are hitting a home run when it comes to habitat quality for deer. Now, it might be harder to hunt them because they're in the cover and they don't have to go very far to eat.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's something the hunter can figure out. The biggest problem is the hunter that doesn't have deer on their property that's frustrated.
Yeah, exactly. And let's not forget this, Steve. This is something we talk about a lot, and I don't want our listeners here to think we are giving food plots a priority over habitat. We always try to use the word supplemental in front of food plots. Food
Absolutely.
Plots supplement, they augment, they're icing on the cake. And you can add a tremendous amount of food or forage biomass on a few acres because those plants really, you know, they produce a lot of growth. But a deer population is built on habitat.
That's right.
Both in terms of cover, in terms of food, in terms of travel corridors, and on an annual cycle. So priority is habitat, and foods supplement that. Do we want to tell people? Do we want to go through the list of all the different deer plants that that they prefer?
Heaven no. Heavens no. I, in my large mammal ecology class that I teach here at Mississippi State, it's a, you know, I spend much of the semester talking about deer, white-tailed deer in particular, ecology and management. And even in that class, I don't spend a lot of time talking about all the different species of plants that white-tailed deer are going to eat, even in Mississippi. In the several different studies of food habits for whitetails around the Southeast, and it's been shown that whitetails have eaten more than 400 different species of plants. And in Mississippi, a deer, a whitetail will eat red maple in the upper coastal plain, but not very preferentially. They'll eat red maple preferentially in the lower coastal plain of Mississippi. And that's the same species of plant, but in one part of the state where it's just an average quality plant, they're not really that interested in it. But in another part of the state where it's actually a much better quality plant than most of the other species of plants around it, its importance to the deer increases dramatically. So there's so many different species of plants that deer eat, and then what's good in one place isn't necessarily going to be good in another. And so if we start talking about species of plants, we'll be talking so specifically that what we say won't even matter outside of Starkville.
Gotcha. So if someone is interested in maybe learning a little bit more in their area, they should probably just contact their state wildlife agency or the extension service within their the university where they're at if they want to get some the really most popular deer plants in their region.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things I teach in my class about learning what plants deer like to eat is go out in your woods and put up a 6-foot fence, just a 10 by 10 foot fence, some corner T-posts, put up a, 100, if it's 10 feet by 10 feet, it'd be 100 square feet, and do that maybe 4 or 5 different places and leave it alone. And after the first growing season, you'll see plants growing in that little enclosure that aren't growing on the outside. And you go in and you learn what those plants are. And those are the plants that deer are eating on your property.
You know what else that'll do? That'll give you a good index of your deer density as well.
Yes, it
will. That'll show you the difference between inside and outside. Just like we recommend with food plots, putting out enclosure cages.
Yeah.
So you can monitor the growth. You can tell which forages are preferred more than others.
Yeah.
So just do it in the woods as well. And you can learn a lot about your deer herd. So rather than talking about species of plants, maybe we should tell people about the categories or the types.
Yeah, I think so. And, the classic categories that biologists talk about.
So we typically think of deer forage. We break it into browse, forbs, mast, grass, and a little bit of lichens and fungi. So the question always comes up, Steve. A lot of times there's two words there that trip people up. Number one is forbs. What in the world is forbs? What kind of fancy word is that? That's just a broadleaf plant. So when we differentiate it from browse, browse we typically think of as woody. It's more of a woody plant. You can think of a shrub or a tree. We typically think of that more as browse.
But, of course, those leaves are also broad-leaved.
They're broad-leaved.
But they're wooded.
Yep.
The stems are woody.
It's a woody stem. We think of forb as herbaceous.
Yeah.
So it's green all the way, not 100% of the time, but green all the way to the bottom, more a softer, herbaceous, what a lot of people would call a weed.
Yeah.
But not a grass. And then a grass is a grass. Everybody knows what a grass is. But so think of that, what a forb is, and a forb is probably the single most important, well, there's no doubt about it. It is the most important category of plants for deer in terms of their quality. And then we use the term mast. Mast, of course, the most common example would be an acorn. But mast is really a seed. So we think of it as soft mast would be a persimmon, soft mast would be a blackberry, soft mast, what's some other one? Dogwood.
Mm-hmm. Apples.
Apples.
Pears, like people like plant pear trees and apple trees. That's a mast.
That's a mast. That's right. And then the classic hard mast, acorns, hickory nuts, things like that.
Pecans.
Yeah. Pecans, yeah. So those are the categories. And within that, we definitely see some preference. So if you look at all these studies and if you look at them within these categories, Steve, there's some clear preference for what deer choose.
Yeah. In fact, just looking across the country, across North America, really, there's going to be a good bit of seasonal variation, too. But let's just keep it simple. Generally, browse is going to make up 40 to 50% of the annual diet of white-tailed deer. And again, it's going to vary a lot depending upon how much wooded browse area there is. If you're in a primarily agricultural crop area, your browse composition might not be as high, but generally speaking, about 50% of a deer's diet is going to be browse throughout the year. And then our buddy the forb is going to be around 30%. Again, general average across the country. So browse, 50%, forbs, 30%. That's 80% of the diet right there. And those are the two major classes that are important. Now, let's not let the listener get confused. You made the comment about forbs being so important. And let's go ahead and clarify why you said that.
Number one, typically, you know, we got to always say on the average here, they're more important because they typically have more nutrients. The nutrient concentration of those plants is greater, the most common being crude protein. So if you look at a browse species and you look at a forb species, the crude protein is always higher, and we always see greater preference. So the listener's probably sitting here thinking, but you said there's 50% of the diet is browse and only 30% is forbs, and that's because of availability. Within a year, so on a property, usually there's a lot more browse available than there is forbs available. And then over the year, you know, there's not a lot of forbs that are available after frost and until spring green up. Mm-hmm. So it's more than likely just always a function of the availability of forbs versus the ever-present availability of browse. Here's an example, Steve, from where you and I spent time earlier in our careers was in South Texas. So mesquite, for example, is browse. So whether they have rainfall or not, and whether there's forbs on the landscape or not, which is driven by rainfall, but there's always browse. So they can always maintain themselves on browse. But when it rains, or in the southeast, after that prescribed burn, or after the disking, or after the forest management, and we get forbs back on the landscape, then we see a shift to the preference of forbs. Mm-hmm. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. So what you're saying then is the browse is kind of like the lettuce that I go over to put under my salad. It's there. It's important. But really what's getting me to enjoy that salad is the stuff that I put on top of it. The majority of the salad is the lettuce, but that's not what really is taking me over there, getting me to eat that salad. It's the other parts that are really more important.
Yeah. Your mouth probably doesn't water when you think about lettuce. That's with nothing correct on it. But it's providing you some nutrients and it's providing you fiber. But the goodies are the forbs, in this case, your croutons and bacon bits and whatever veggies you spread on top. That's the forb.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve, so we always hear, and I remember when I was growing up, you know, when we're looking at a place to lease or a place to hunt, you start looking for those oak trees. We start talking about mast or acorns. And, you know, what you and I've noticed over the years, it seems to be a disproportionate number of people think that mast or acorns is really what drives, you know, the deer population. Mm-hmm. And it's just not the case.
That's right. And now, before we talk about the most general situations where that's not the case, there are some areas of the country that are extremely mast dependent to get through the winter if there's not a good solid mast. You know, there's just no food to speak of during the wintertime because you have a closed canopy forest. And so if they don't get a good mast crop, there's going to be starvation during the wintertime. But that's because there's not browse available within the reach of the deer, that they have to live on the mast to get them through the winter. So it's not necessarily the way it should be, it's just the way it is in some places. And, you know,
Let me stop you there, though,
sure.
Steve. But if that area, property, system, whatever you want to call it, if it were managed differently, that would not be the case.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah.
So they're in a situation where they have to depend on mast because right. there's nothing else.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But back to the, you know, why are people so excited about mast is same reason I get excited about, you know, if someone wanted to capture me, they would best set up a Bluebell ice cream, free Bluebell ice cream dispensary.
Oh, yeah.
And they'd have me come in there.
Yeah.
And they could count on it. If they rang a bell when it was opening, I'd hear that bell and I'd come running because I love Bluebell ice cream. And that's essentially what, you know, acorns are to deer. They love them because they provide an important source of energy to them.
They're not high in protein.
No.
Yeah.
No, they just, you know, they give a lot of, you know, Bluebell homemade vanilla is not really high in protein, but I just enjoy it. And acorns don't provide a lot of protein either, but the deer enjoy it and they benefit from it ultimately because they have to, it helps add on fat so they can in fact get through the winter.
Right.
Now I'm trying to go the other direction. I'm not trying to add fat. That's why I'm eating salads instead of the Bluebell.
Yeah. You need to lay off the acorns.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. But anyway, you know, when you think about the deer hunting magazines, every year they have run the same kinds of stories. Which are better? Red oaks or white oaks? What this kind of red oak, is it better than this kind of red oak or this kind of white oak? And should you fertilize them or how should you manage your oaks? It's almost like, you know, when you and I were younger and reading Field and Stream and Outdoor Life, every year each magazine would have an article on what was the best deer rifle? What was the best deer caliber for hunting deer? Same question every year.
Mm-hmm.
Different opinions on it. You know what? All you need to do is hit the deer with a dang high-speed projectile in the right place. It doesn't matter whether it's a .30-06 or a .308 or 7mm or, you know, Nosler bullets or whatever. Hit, make a good kill shot.
That's right. And
it's going on the ground. And so I get tired of seeing those kinds of articles in magazines that are educating people and they're not reading and hearing about the things that we know, that I know, and you too, Bronson, know that are much more important. You know, mast is great. Deer love it when it's there. But the mast is generally going to be on the ground for about 3 months at most. And yes, they're going to relish it while they're there. Some years we have mast failures. Other years we have booms. And, you know, this past fall was a great mast year. Any given tree is going to have a good year and then a bad year and a good year and a bad year and maybe 3 bad years in a row. I mean, it's okay, but I get frustrated when people place so much emphasis on mast.
I guess, Steve, I think of, and then, yeah, well, let's refine. In this case, mast, let's go to acorns.
Yeah.
I think of it more from a hunting perspective than a management perspective. So I know you have capitalized on knowing that particular white oak or that particular red or whatever species
sure.
is actively dropping. And you see deer scat, you see tracks, and, okay, I'm going to get 20 yards away from this and climb a tree with my bow, and I'm going to capitalize on them using that tree and the mast, the acorns from that tree. But when we talk about habitat management, we're not really talking about growing oak trees to grow the deer population or to grow bigger antlers or to improve nutrition or diet quality. We're talking about forbs for that, not mast.
Yeah, forbs and then the leafy part of mast trees.
Yeah.
Browse and forbs are what make up 80% of the diet of the white-tailed deer through the 12 months of the year. You don't want to focus your management efforts on what makes up a proportion of their diet during 2 or 3 months out of the year.
A small proportion of their diet, a small proportion of the year.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, Steve, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk about something I know I never thought about until I became a wildlife biologist. And so I'm going to assume a lot of people don't think of it this way, but what we call herbivory. You know, that's the act of an herbivore, in this case a deer, extracting food or gathering food, or, you know, its process for doing that. And really what it gets down to ecologically, it's predator versus prey. Now, we always think of the deer as the prey, and the mountain lion, the bobcat, the coyote, et cetera, is the predator. But in this case, in the world of herbivory, the deer is the predator and the plant is the prey.
Yep.
And so over time, you know, we always say the arms race is always a classic example in ecology and evolution. The arms race, they go back and forth. One gets better, the other one has to get better and match and match and match. And, you know, they change over time because of that. And so what we see with herbivores and plants is that plants have to adapt to the constant feeding and browsing, whether it be a deer, a rabbit, an insect. But these plants change by, you know, a lot of people don't think of plant defenses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, okay, here's a classic. What's a plant defense probably an elementary student might think of? They might think of a Venus flytrap or something like that.
Or thorns on a rose bush.
And that's one of them. So one of the classic defenses of a plant is what we call mechanical. So it is literally growing a specialized type of tissue to prevent or at least discourage. I sure wouldn't want to, you know, bite off on something with a bunch of thorns on it. But there's a lot of critters then, a lot of herbivores have then adapted to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And you see that on the plains of Africa. You know, they have a specialized tongue or a specialized, the long neck of a giraffe, the width of their mouth, et cetera, et cetera. But so they go back and forth. The other part is, we call them secondary compounds, chemicals. So the plant will actually start generating an anti-herbivory chemical that is either going to taste bad to the animal, or for lack of a better word, give them indigestion when it's over. So they get that post-ingestive negative feedback that they associate with that plant. But
kind of like with the salad stuff that I tried over at the salad bar that I kind of just didn't sit well with me, and I stopped using it.
You got a bad read from that. Yeah, you got a bad feeling, and so, yeah, you don't go back to that. So those types of dynamics are going on all the time. They have been for eons,
mm-hmm.
And then where you are in terms of geographically and the time of the year, there's going to be a bunch of different plants that the deer is adapted to or has learned how to capitalize on, how to extract nutrients from that plant.
Yeah.
And that kind of stimulates their cravings for those plants.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the big picture theory of how this changes over time. But Steve, let's talk about, and this is something you talk about in your class, let's talk about the more physiological side of these adaptations of a deer. How are they physiologically adapted to capitalize on certain types of plants?
Yeah, okay. Well, let me start out with just kind of a picture. Have you ever tried to eat an acorn?
Yes.
Okay, I have too. I think every deer biologist in the world has bitten into an acorn. And, you know, maybe a portion of our listeners have done also. You know, let's see why these deer like this so much. And you bite into that thing as a yow.
Yeah.
Can't spit it out of your mouth quick enough.
I did not get a good feedback.
No.
Yeah.
Terrible. That extremely astringent, bitter taste of an acorn, that is due to a plant secondary compound called tannins. And that's a defense mechanism to prevent unadapted creatures from eating the acorns. We wouldn't do well eating acorns. Tannin actually binds protein, and so it makes it undigestible. So if you eat a high tannin compound food, you are unable to get the benefit of the protein in it. So why bother? Now, humans use acorns, boil them, and you know, the tanning of hides early in, you know, back in the day from acorns, using those secondary compounds in the acorns to help tan a hide to make it so that it wouldn't degrade, wouldn't digest, so that the protein in the skin of the hide would be bound and not digestible and not degrade. That's why skins were tanned using acorns, boiled acorns. You didn't know that, did you? Maybe you did.
It had been a while, but yeah, that does conjure up some memories, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's just say I did know it.
Okay.
Yeah, how about that?
Okay. Yeah, and I got, you know, sometimes I get rambling. Sorry.
Yeah.
But point is, you know, compounds in acorns are an anti-herbivory. Cattle, livestock, domestic cattle can die from eating too much acorns. And yet, any hunter that's harvested a deer in an oak flat, when they gut them, if they take the time to open up the stomach, the rumen portion of the stomach, it's going to be full of acorns. Deer are adapted to eating acorns. They have very specialized salivary glands that are much more developed than, say, cows or even equivalent wild to a cow would be a bison or a buffalo. They're not adapted to eating compounds or plants that have a lot of tannins in them. They're more of a grass eater, and grasses don't have tannins in them. Browse, almost all browse has some amount of tannin, and the majority of plants that have tannins in them are browse species. And so if you're going to be an animal that eats browse, and whitetails, like we said, 50% of their annual diet is going to be browse, they better be adapted to eating those kinds of compounds. So they have these specialized salivary glands. But before we get out of the head area, you know, whitetails are going to have a really narrow snout, and they have a long tongue, and they can use that narrow snout and long tongue to kind of find their way in through the branches of a browse plant or a forb and look for their favorite part. They don't have to just try to grab a whole handful of it as, you know, a big mouthful of whatever's there and find out that there's a bunch of big thorns in it. You know, whitetails, their narrow mouth is adapted to kind of avoid the thorns, get around them, and grab a leaf off of that thorn bush.
So what is, I'm generalizing here, what is typically the part they are selecting for?
The leaf.
Yeah.
And ideally, the newly growing leaf.
Yeah.
The most highly digestible part of the plant is the newer growth on the plant.
And the greatest concentration of nutrients, at least in terms of crude protein and yes. Digestibility. And
yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we got, you know, the narrow head, the salivary glands. You know, that's kind of the beginning of the gastrointestinal tract on a whitetail. What's really critical beyond that, once they've ingested the forage, and you know what we talked earlier about, a prey is going to want to go out and eat and then go back and hide. And so, you know, deer are prey for natural predators and then for hunters. And so their way of life is to go out and eat as quick as they can and then go back and rest. And while they're resting in cover, they're going to actually do what the rest of the, you know, what our parents, our mothers would say, you know, chew your food 20 times before you swallow it. Deer don't do that. Deer mother never says that to her fawn. She says, eat as much of that, swallow it, and we're running out of here and we're going to go hide.
That's choke it down as quick as you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they have this large vat, basically the rumen portion of their stomach. And they can take this food back, and then once they're in their cover and resting, they can actually belch the big leaves that they've bitten off and chew them more properly. They get the 2 through 20 bites chews in, whereas they took the one bite, swallowed it, and the other 19 chews that our mothers wanted us to do, that's where they do it. They chew their food more completely. And then, you know, the compartmentalization of the rumen is relatively minimal in a deer. So the rumen doesn't hold the forage is very long. Within 12 to 20 hours, the forages are moving on into the next part of digestive system. You know, they've been belched up and chewed and swallowed back and belched back up and chewed some more and swallowed back. And once they get small particles, they kind of move on down into the omasum and the abomasum. The abomasum being the, you know, the classic, what we think, what you'd think of as a human stomach, where you have acid digestion and enzymes digesting. And, you know, the big thing about the rumen is while that forage is being in there, sitting in there for maybe up to 20 hours, there's bacteria and protozoans that are living in that. It's almost like a little microcosm, a little, little vat of digestion taking place, because deer, like us, we can't digest cellulose. Deer cannot digest cellulose. A major portion of plants is cellulose. And so they allow, you know, they rely on bacteria to digest the cellulose. Bacteria then the food for the protozoans. Protozoans and bacteria, as they die, they're ingested by the deer, and then they're also digesting the plant part. So that whole rumen is
it's
really
a whole
important.
Ecosystem.
It is.
It's an ecosystem within the rumen.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's amazing.
But in a deer, it's not highly developed in terms of compartmentalized. So forages in a deer's rumen don't stay in as nearly as long as, say, a bison or a buffalo, which have much more compartmentalization, because the forages they're eating are even less digestible than what the deer are eating. So they need to hold on to them longer.
Steve, you bring up a great point, because you just jogged my memory. When we were talking a moment ago about forage categories, I've rambled on and on about the benefits of forbs and the benefits of browse and so forth. And then mast, but I neglected to talk about grass. And when I'm giving seminars, and we're both giving seminars and teaching, I like to always show a picture of this pasture. And here's this ruminant, here's this herbivore, a cow, or it could be a bison, whatever. And tell people that even though this is beautiful, this pasture grass is beautiful, and these cows are getting fat and sassy off of it, a deer is not going to do well and possibly starve, because just like the cow or the bison is not adapted to the acorns, the deer is not adapted to eat that much grass.
That's right.
And when you get to this physiological, these differences you're talking about, one of the coolest things is, I believe that was Hoffman's classification, mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah.
What has always been really neat to me is that when you increase the proportion of grass in an herbivore's diet, the larger the rumen has to be relatively. So if you had two equally sized, let's just say they're both 500 pounds, be a small cow or a big deer, both of them are 500 pounds, and that cow is eating grass, he's got to have a much larger rumen to deal with what you're talking about, all that fiber, all that cellulose.
Mm-hmm.
And so the very way that you're talking about a deer is adapted to take advantage of the plant, the particular parts of a plant, the really nutritious parts, to take advantage of the acorns, they're not adapted to eat all this grass.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's not even just more or less a preference or a taste thing. Their body is not physiologically apt to do that.
Yeah.
They're different than a cow. They're different than a bison.
Absolutely. And the rest of their tract, after the stomach, you have the small intestine, the cecum, and then the large intestine. That is dramatically different than a bison or a cow as well. So when you take the sum total of the gastrointestinal tract of a whitetail, it's less complex and shorter than a bison or a cow that's adapted to eating a grass diet that has lower protein and less digestibility. So cows eat stuff that's not very high in protein, but they take their time and get relatively more out of it in the process. Whitetails, they're going to process their food through relatively quickly. And if it's not highly digestible and higher quality protein, then they're not going to benefit from it. And that's why, literally, whitetails can starve to death eating grass, because they process it through quickly, relatively quickly, and they can't get enough out of it to survive on.
So that's it. If we've said it once, we'll say it at least one or two more times: browse and forage.
And within those plants, the more nutritious, the higher quality parts are the actively growing portions. So if you have a spring green up, everything as it's coming out is going to be actively growing and highly palatable and digestible. And then come 2 months later, you know, everything's finished growing. But then you get a flush of a rain flush, and then you might get a new flush of growth. Well, if you continue to see those flushes of new growth throughout the summer in response to rain, then the deer are getting better quality forage because of those flushes of rain, flushes of growth.
So let's get back to this then. We've done the broad categorization of these browse and forbs or broadleaf plants. Let's get back to Steve. So why do deer eat so many different species? Why are they not concentrating on just four or five?
Well, it's not in their best interest to concentrate on one or two or three or four plants, because they're in there for, deer are there for the long haul. And this great plant, like soybeans, farmers planting a soybean crop, they're going to love it. They're going to eat a lot of it. And if they base their entire life on that soybean plant that is only going to be there 4 months out of the year, they're hosed.
Yeah.
You know, deer are in it for the long haul. So they are constantly trying new plants, constantly trying new opportunities for foraging. They're looking forward. It's kind of a longer term look. They're always trying something new to see if, well, is this going to be potentially a good food for me? And they learn a little bit at a time. And going back to your mother, she probably told mm-hmm. you, well, try it. Yeah, you've never had this vegetable, but go ahead and just try it. You might like it. No, I don't want it. I don't want it. And it was different.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Deer, you know, they're generally going to try new things because it's in their best interest long term to know whether or not there's potential value to it.
So let's wrap up here, Steve, with we always like a take-home message. We've talked about a lot of knowledge. We've brought forth a lot of knowledge. Why? Now let's get to some how. Let's talk about habitat management. So based on this, what are strategies for a manager to produce the greatest and highest quality amount of food?
All right. Well, deer are wanting to look at and evaluate a lot of different species of plants. So across the landscape, the more diversity you have in the species of plants that are present will allow deer to be more able to pick and choose and find exactly what they need when they need it. Kind of like the old Kevin Costner movie about the baseball field and the corn out in the corn field. You know, if you build it, they will come. They didn't come the first day he built the field, but eventually they came. And if you build a deer habitat that is widely diverse, a lot of species of forbs and browse occurring across the landscape, deer will come because they'll be able to find what they need when they need it in this habitat. And if you have a lot of diversity of browse and forbs, and they're within reach of deer, you've got excellent cover as well. So it goes back to my earlier comment. Best thing you can do is have cover and food coexisting in a small area, and you've met the needs of the deer. And then, so you've got them on your property because they want to be there.
Yeah.
You're meeting their needs. And then it's up to you to figure out, okay, I've got them here. Now how am I going to find them to harvest them when I want them? Or when I can harvest them.
But that's a good problem to have.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Steve, let's make sure people don't get tripped up on the diversity. I don't think anyone ever needs to worry about, do I have enough plant diversity? I think it's, if you are managing habitat, you will have the diversity. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want someone to think I need to go buy native seeds and plant or anything.
No.
If you are managing, and Steve, we're going to have a lot more podcasts devoted to habitat management, but one little thing to say here is to get this combination of food and cover requires sunlight.
Yes.
And so wherever you're at in the country, how you get that sunlight will vary based on how the landscape is used. In the Southeast, typically the best way to get sunlight is a chainsaw.
Mm-hmm.
So openings grow, whether it be a pasture or whether it was a clear cut, but eventually in the South, it's going to end up as a forest.
Yes.
That's the way it wants to be eventually. And it usually takes clearing some timber, whether it be thinning or a complete harvest or whatever. That is what gets sunlight back on the ground, and that is what allows those broadleaf herbaceous plants to grow. And as soon as it starts growing out of that, as soon as our forest starts to overtake that young herbaceous plants, those forbs, we run a fire through it,
yes,
or a fire and herbicide treatment or something like that. Mm-hmm. But that's how we keep that mix of browse and forbs for food and cover,
mm-hmm,
on the landscape.
Yeah. And really the key is disturbance.
Disturbance.
If you're not disturbing your land, you're not promoting diversity.
Yep.
And the word disturb kind of has a negative connotation, but it really shouldn't. It's good for the land to disturb it. It promotes new growth, and new growth promotes highly digestible forages and generally higher quality forages for deer, and it's a good thing. Now, let's also not let the listener get too confused while we're talking about habitat management and timber management and managing the habitat. We don't have a problem with supplemental food plots. They're great. I've hunted over them myself, and I know you have. You've planted food plots yourself. Nothing wrong with some small areas, monoculture, without any diversity. Just have a single food plot crop, or maybe two or three mixes. But, you know, we're not talking about diversity when we're talking about a food plot, a supplemental food plot. Diversity is what I want to see when I look in outside of the food plot, in
right,
the natural habitat.
Yeah, and Steve, to that point, as much as we love and promote habitat management, that's what we want, we think that's the best. Yeah, part of our recommendations are always, 99% of the time, yeah, it's going to include some food plots as well. It's especially important for a large number of hunters that lease the land they hunt. They can't go manage the habitat. They can't manage the timber because they don't own the land. But a lot of times they will have the option to plant food plots. And you know what, Steve? That's a great topic for another podcast, which we will have time and time again in the future. We're going to talk coming up in the next few podcasts. We'll have some more habitat management topics that we'll talk about. And we're also going to talk a lot about food plot management.
Yeah. And you know, I think today's podcast was really important, though, to set the stage for the understanding of when we talk about managing habitat for these kinds of plants. Now our listeners know why those kinds of plants matter, why a whitetail, they have adaptations for highly digestible forages. So now they'll understand why.
Yeah,
we'll say this is what we have to do to the habitat.
Well, so we laid down the why, and the other podcast will be the how.
Yes.
Why you're doing it. Later podcasts will say how to do it. Okay. Well, thank you very much for tuning in for myself and for Steve, and we will see you next time on Deer University. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.